Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the coded racial politics that Trump used in his campaign and continues to deploy in his presidency, with an escalating fury of late in which his dog whistles have turned into a howl. Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class, joins us to discuss the race-class narrative project he is part of that seeks to educate the 99% of Americans who are being manipulated into manufactured racial and cultural divisions to serve the interests of the 1%. We will examine how Trump is the ultimate test case of this strategy, since he ran as a populist but rules as a plutocrat. And in collusion with Fox News, Trump continually riles up his base with racial resentment to get them to vote against their own interests while distracting Americans from realizing that whites, blacks, and browns have so much more in common with each other than they do with the billionaires. Meanwhile, the billionaires are afraid of real democratic representation and have managed to disguise plutocratic rule by buying politicians and dressing up elections with the trappings of democracy. Then we'll speak with the distinguished American philosopher Martha Nussbaum about her new book, Just Out, At a Time of Stark Political Polarization and Cultural Distress, The Monarchy of Fear. A philosopher looks at our political crisis. She joins us to discuss how the political is always emotional and that Trump essentially practices the politics of blame and resentment using the weapon of fear that is both primal and universal. Then finally, we'll assess the nationwide effort by newspapers, big and small, liberal and conservative, to push back against Trump's dangerous demagoguery, branding journalists the enemy of the people as he whips up his supporters at rallies to curse and confront the press doing their job covering America's president. Michael Cohen, a regular contributor to the Boston Globe, which began the nationwide effort to defend journalists and journalism, joins us to discuss his latest article at the Boston Globe, Trump Escalates a Dangerous War on the Press. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Glad to join you.
And it does seem that Donald Trump, who has been dog whistling since he started the Bertha canard with Barack Obama when Obama was president, and he put forth this idea that the president was illegitimate, he didn't have an American birth certificate, he was a Kenyan interloper and an anti-colonial troublemaker. Since he's been elected, he's intensified, but now it's almost, the dog whistle has almost turned into a howl.
I think it's important to understand what we mean by dog whistle. And I think what we're trying to get at with dog whistle is that you have politicians who are intentionally using racially charged language to animate animosity or fear and resentment in their base. But this is language that at the same time allows them to deny, at least to their base, that they're doing any such thing. And so here, when we think about Trump, I think many of us understand that Trump is engaged in racial demagoguery. But we should be clear, his base does not believe that. So there was a really interesting poll that was done week before the election, and the question in the poll was, do you think the word racist describes Donald Trump? And among Clinton voters, the overwhelming majority says, you bet. But among Trump supporters, 87% said no, and only 5% said yes. So Trump's supporters do not believe that he is engaged in racial demagoguery. They think that what he's communicating is common sense, to use a phrase that Trump himself uses an awful lot. Though I think it's very important that what's passing for common sense for them are deeply internalized racial fears and myths.
But the Bertha conspiracy that he ginned up, and basically that launched his political career, if you will, it seems to me that that Bertha conspiracy, in effect, gave Americans who were restrained by what they call political correctness and essentially gave them permission to speak openly in racist terms.
I agree with an awful lot of what you said, except for the openly in racist terms. So listen, here you have the election of the first black president. If this were open racism, you would have heard people saying, I can't believe we just elected an N-word to the White House. That's open racism. The reason the Bertha claim worked so powerfully was because it was a way of talking about racial difference while using non-racial, seemingly non-racial language. So it wasn't, oh, N-word. It was, I don't think he was actually born here. It wasn't, can't stand a black man. It was, I actually think he's Muslim. And so these phrases, so half of Republican voters came to believe that Barack Obama was Muslim. Did it have anything to do with his religious practice? No. It was all about his race, but it was a way for them to express racial doubt without using racial language. So that people who were very fearful of a black man in the White House could say publicly and say internally to themselves, I'm worried about this foreign-born Muslim. It expressed profound doubt rooted in race, but the way it was expressed was not openly racist.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. So I guess the question then would be, why does it work in terms of President Trump's dog whistles? And by the way, he more or less admitted recently when he went after the NFL players, the black NFL players again, and implied in no uncertain manner that they weren't smart enough to know what they were protesting, which is really, I think, grotesquely racist. The assumption is that he did that because it works. It keeps his base on side and keeps them riled up. But why does it work?
It works because it is essentially the right-wing Republican message of the last half century. So dog whistle politics is a technique that Republicans proposed for the first time in 1963. Their candidate Barry Goldwater tries it in 64. They lose then because whites aren't, you know, haven't deeply internalized the message. By 1968, it works a little bit. By 1972, Richard Nixon's dog whistle politics, he calls it the Southern Strategy. It's a national strategy of appealing, using coded terms to appeal to racial fear, wins in a landslide. Republicans have won a majority of the white vote using coded racial messages in every election from 1968 to today. And it's not just that Republicans have been doing this, but if you think about Fox News, Fox News is 24/7 a bullhorn for messages of racial fear. So what Trump is doing is he's echoing messages that many people on the right have been listening to, have been internalizing, have been absorbing for decades. And it's in that sense, he seems to be speaking to and at the same time generating these real racial fears and anxieties about changing demographics, about changing gender roles, about the appearance of transgender people, about new religions and new cultures and new languages, right? Any society has to confront questions of difference, of belonging, of curiosity, of threat. What we have is a society in which a significant element of our leadership, backed by the biggest concentrations of capital, the corporations, the big donors, the family dynasties, they've decided that they're going to purposefully stoke notions of fear and division. That's what we've been doing for 50 years, and that's the path that was so readily available to Donald Trump in 2016.
So is the purpose, then, of using dog whistles and using race to divide the 99% to enrich the 1%? In other words, to take the focus away from the inequality and the growing inequality as the rich get richer and the middle class is stagnant and the working Americans haven't had a raise since the 1970s. Is that the purpose?
I have a two-word answer to that. Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
Donald Trump, a billionaire, so-called self-professed billionaire, who only really cares about his bank account and the bank accounts of people like him, just passed the largest tax cut for billionaires in the history of the country. And 90% of Republican supporters, voters, still support him. Why? Because they're keen on giving money away to billionaires? No. When you look at who voted for Donald Trump, the vast bulk of people who voted for Donald Trump have family incomes between $30,000 and $100,000 a year. This is the working class, lower middle class. They are racially fearful whites who believe that the biggest problem in their lives are people of color or other poor and working class people of color, because that's what they're being told by a wealthy elite who've adopted racism as a divide and distract weapon. The rich are busy writing the rules for themselves, giving themselves big tax cuts, stacking the cabinet with other billionaires, and meanwhile, they're saying to working whites, hey, look over there, it's a black man. He might be on welfare. He's ripping off the system. Oh, hey, look over there, it's a brown-skinned man. I think he might be illegal. It is 100% a divide-and-distract weapon of the 1% against the 99%.
So what will break that mendacious spell? In other words, at what point do working class whites, Latinos, African Americans recognize that they have more in common with each other than they do with the 1% who are basically, you know, taking the cream and leaving them in the lurch?
I think that political revolution, and it is truly the political revolution that we need, that revolution can start today. I have been working with a team of pollsters and linguists and think tanks, and we just completed a study that we're calling the race hyphen class narrative project. It's been written up in The Nation, it's been written up in Salon, it's been written up at The Atlantic, the race class narrative project. And what we proved through national polling is that we have a very powerful story that can unite people across race lines into a truly multiracial class movement. And here's the basic story. They're using race as a divide-and-distract weapon. We come together in cross-racial solidarity. Through cross-racial solidarity, we take back government from the rich. And once we have control of government, we use that to create a broad and shared prosperity for all of us and to promote racial justice. 3 points: cross-racial solidarity, get government back, through government, prosperity, and racial justice. That basic narrative, those three elements, cross-racial solidarity, get government back, shared prosperity, and racial justice, that's a very powerful narrative, and we tested it nationally with over 2,000 people, and that message performs better than the standard Democratic message, which we're calling colorblind economic populism, the sort of, we're going to talk about economics, but we won't address race, works much better than that, because people know we're being racially divided, and they want politicians who are willing to name it. And it also works much better than the right-wing message of racial fear. So there's a way to talk about racism as a weapon of the rich against all of us that works today to defeat dog whistle politics and to lay the groundwork for a truly multiracial working class movement, a truly multiracial democracy, I would say.
And earlier, Ian Hanley-Lopez, you mentioned Nixon's Southern strategy. Prior to that, of course, the Democrats had the Dixiecrats, the Southern white racists. And then when LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act during the Civil Rights period, in 64-65, he said to an aide, the Democrats have just lost the South. And sure enough, Nixon came along and proved that to be the point. So what do you do about that? If you have a kind of core, kind of atavistic part of America that, even though they say we have the new South, it's pretty clear that the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, has become the party of the Southern racists, in effect. So how do you deal
with that? Right. There's no doubt that there are regional differences in terms of whites' commitment to the idea that being white is an important aspect of who they are and a source of pride. There's no doubt that there's regional differences. So that said, I mean, I think there are important changes happening in the South. But look, here's what's happened over the last 50 years. One change that's positive, one change that's really negative. The positive change is that the idea of racial equality has continued to spread. It has spread in terms of who we see in our culture, who we see in sports, who we see in business, who we see in politics. I mean, the election and re-election of Barack Obama is really a monumental testament to a spreading idea of equality. Contested, to be sure, but spreading them nonetheless. So that's a positive development. Here's a negative development. Over the last 50 years, the right has been able to use a message of racial fear to convince a majority of whites to support policies that are only good for billionaires, with the result that working people in the United States, working families in the United States, have suffered terrible losses over the last 50 years. Pensions gone, unions gone, home equity gone, health care unaffordable, education unaffordable. And the confluence of those two creates a moment that we've never seen in the history of the United States, a moment when it's possible to say to all Americans, but in a way that's especially convincing to whites, to say to them, listen, racial equality is the way forward, and racism among whites is the biggest threat in the lives of all of us, including in the lives of whites. It's the biggest threat because it's what's empowering people like Donald Trump to rip off the country. Right? And so, and that message, this message is different in 2018 than it would have been in 1968 with Richard Nixon. And the message is different for these two reasons. In 1968, the cultural and material advantages of whiteness were still very high, right? I mean, we had barely contested the idea that whites were a superior race. Most whites continued to assume they were superior, continued to feel consciously or unconsciously that being white was essential to who they were and was evidence of their goodness and all of that nonsense. And at the same time, jobs were segregated, neighborhoods were segregated, schools were segregated. There were substantial material advantages to being white. Both of those have changed. Among many whites, the sort of cultural advantage of being white, they're not invested in that anymore, or not so much, not very much. Whereas the material benefits of being white, completely swamped by the material harm of so many whites voting their racial fears. That, right? And so it's not that people see that. It's not that that's how whites are thinking about it now, but it's what we can convince people of. It's what we can say, hey, listen, you really want to understand what happened over the last 50 years? It wasn't brown-skinned or black-skinned people. It wasn't Asian Americans or Native Americans. It was the very rich, and they rigged the rules, and they robbed the rest of us. And how did they do that? Through racism as a divide and distract. That story can help switch people's perspective on what happened to them and where the threat is coming from and what they need to do to come together to move forward.
Well, you've made it very clear, Ian Haney-Lopez, how race has been weaponized by the GOP. But the other, just in closing, aspect of the GOP is that it's driven by what appears to be a totalitarian impulse. The Democrats have to win at least 8% more votes just to break even. By 2040, there'll be 70 Republican seats in the Senate because of the Electoral College and 30 Democrats. The tide is against them. they don't want just to win in a competition with the Democrats. They want to extinguish them. They want to defund them by stacking the Supreme Court with the Gorsuches and this Kavanaugh character that they want to put on, who will be the final nail in the coffin. So I'd like to get your analysis of, do you recognize that totalitarian impulse, and where does it come from?
It is. I wouldn't say totalitarian. That has a lot of baggage. It has very specific meanings. I would say what's happening is, it is crystal clear that the forces of concentrated wealth, the greedy rich in our society, are profoundly anti-democratic. They do not believe in democracy. So they're quite happy to exploit democratic processes to gain power. For example, by fooling as many voters as they can, by funding different politicians, by essentially buying votes in legislatures. They're quite happy to exploit democratic processes. But at the end of the day, they do not believe in democracy as a project. They actually see democracy as a project as dangerous to them. And so they're willing to back, and the politicians they help get elected, that they fund, are willing to back policies that effectively disenfranchise as many Americans as possible, and especially people who are poor, people who are working class, people who are young, people of color. Right? This is the politics. It's a profoundly anti-democratic politics. Why? Because the project of democracy in every society, the project of democracy is to create a sense of social solidarity, of shared belonging, of linked fate, and to push power and wealth downward and outward. Right? That's the project of democracy. That's what we mean by a democracy that cares about all its members. These folks don't want a democracy. They want a plutocracy. They want rule by the rich. And rule by the rich can take different forms. It can be totalitarian. It can be authoritarianism. The core is it can be a theocracy. They want rule by the rich. And rule by the rich is the antithesis of democracy. So they are, at root, profoundly anti-democratic, at the same time that they consistently seek to exploit democratic processes and democratic norms, and indeed even liberal values like First Amendment, free speech. It's a very, very cynical ploy. They're not interested in democratic values and liberal values. They're interested in rule by the rich. That's what they're funding. That's what they're paying for. That's what they expect to get from the politicians that they bankroll.
Well, Ian Haye-Lopez, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Haye-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the distinguished American philosopher, Martha Nussbaum, about her new book, The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis.